Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Order Committee to order. Looks like we have a quorum. So I would like to just make sure that we recognize we're approving two sets of minutes. So first, it looks like we didn't get them approved for March 17th. So Vice Chair Schwartz, would you move the minutes of Tuesday, March 17th?
Yes.
Thank you. Is there any discussion of the minutes from March 17th? Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, was the motion, so you moved to approve the minutes?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Thank you.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Minutes of March 17th are approved. Next, we'll move to approve the March 24th minutes. Vice Chair Coulter, have you had a chance to review those minutes?
As long as there are absolutely no follow-up questions, yes. And I will move their approval.
Thank you, Vice Chair Coulter. So we, all those in favor of the minutes from March 24th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes of March 24th are adopted. Thank you. So first up today, we're going to get through several bills that we have heard before, but were laid on the table. So we're going to start today with HF 1323 from Representative Schultz. Undocumented non-citizens are being made ineligible through this bill for state programs. Our intention is to send this bill to Ways and Means. Since we have already heard this bill, we will be not taking any new testimony from the public. Representative Schultz, I understand you have an A1 and A2 amendment to get the bill in your proper working order.
That's correct, Madam Chair. I would love to adopt the A1 amendment. Do that first.
All right. Why don't you explain the A1 briefly for the members?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee. This simply gets the bill up to date with the current dates and the years specifically for this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? All right. I think the ayes have it. The A1 is adopted. All right. Let's move on to the A2. Representative Schultz, please explain the A2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we were working to establish an appropriate fiscal note for this bill, additional clarity was needed for the A2 amendment, and so I would ask for your support of the A2 amendment to get it in the shape that I would like this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the A2?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Madam Chair, we'd like to request a roll call vote.
On the A2? Absolutely.
Yes.
A roll call being requested. We will have a roll call. Any further discussion on the A2? Seeing
Madam
none.
Chair.
Oh, yes, ma'am. I don't know who said that. Oh, yes. Chair Rarick, nice to see you. I'm sorry I didn't see your hand. Please state your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so we've kind of struggled over this bill as to hone in on exactly what population and what programs we're talking about. So even this morning, we had quite an extensive meeting with the Office of Higher Education, and what we are intending to do with this bill is that we are just focusing on the student aid, not all the other grant programs. And so I believe the A2 is supposed to get to that issue, and they had suggested that we include the state aid programs and not the other types of grants that do flow through OHE, and there are quite a few other things that flow through OHE. So this is focused solely on just the student aid portions, which is pretty substantial still. So that's the clarity. I'm really glad that we had that meeting with OHE. And if there's any other questions, I'm sure they're in the room that they can explain why we need this bill and why we couldn't get an updated fiscal note because of this confusion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. Is there any, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And I don't know if maybe fiscal staff or somebody could help me understand that a little bit better, but I see we have a fiscal note here, but now I'm understanding that the A2 amendment is going to change that fiscal note. Is that correct?
If I can speak to that, Representative Hansen, no, the A2 amendment is in response to the updated fiscal note. So that's why we needed to make the change from the previous time we heard the bill. Yes, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And just to clarify, so the fiscal note that's in front of us does take into consideration as if we were to adopt the A2. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I see
Thank
nodding
you.
Heads. Okay.
Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, as a point of clarification, the fiscal note that was included in member packets references the as-introduced version. So should the committee adopt or act favorably and adopt the A2 amendment, that would likely potentially change assumptions within the fiscal note. So, and to that point, a new one is already on order for this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. And could you speculate as to when we might see that new fiscal note?
Chair and members, standard fiscal note deadline is approximately 10 business days. So we should see it potentially when the committee would return from break. And if the bill is sent to Ways and Means, then the expectation it would be ready for Ways and Means, it being about a week and a half to go.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. Yes. So the intention will be that we can get it addressed in Ways and Means because they have to see it. And I see Chair Rarick is waiting to speak again. Representative Rarick.
Yeah, so just in reference to the meeting that Chair Robbins and I had with OHE just this morning, the fiscal note in essence is done. It's just the Legislative Budget Office wasn't willing to sign off on it because of this confusion. And so they asked for this amendment. So they actually have it ready to go. They just need a sign off from the Legislative Budget Office. And so it actually could get done very, very quickly because on OHE side it is done and they have done it with the, let's just say, legislative intent, what we had wanted in the bill. And so they put the fiscal note together in relation to that, but we just couldn't get sign off because we needed the clarity in this, in the bill itself. So it should be very, very quickly. So once this amendment is adopted, it should be a quick turnaround. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. Chair Wilgamott.
Madam Chair, I will withdraw my request for a roll call vote.
Thank you. So noted. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at the amendment, I just wonder about this language. Funded by state tax revenue that benefits the student individually. You know, in my mind, education benefits not just a student individually, but all of us, and I think I made a pretty clear statement about that the other day. So I wonder, I don't know if I've seen language like this in a bill before, and I wonder what that exactly means and how it's defined, tax revenue or awards that benefit a student individually.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, would you like to address that, or would you like me to invite OHE up to talk about this amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would think that the best answer for the committee would come from OHE. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Could someone from OHE please come to the testifier table? Good morning, nice to see you, or good afternoon, nice to see you. Please state your name for the record, and if you want us to restate the question, we're happy to do that.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Andrew Wold. I'm General Counsel at the Office of Higher Education, and yes, please repeat the question. Sorry, just walked in a minute.
Chair Liebling.
All right, thank you. So looking at the A2 amendment, it's the very last few words in the A2 amendment talk about where a grant, scholarship, or other financial aid benefits the student individually. And I just wonder if there's a definition of that anywhere in state law, because in my mind, educational grants, scholarships, and financial aid that allow students to get education are not just an individual benefit to the student. They are a benefit to all of us, which is why we do it in the first place, I believe. We're not just giving gifts to individuals when we give them state aid. So I wonder if you could define that for us.
Go, Mr. Wald.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Thank you, Chair Liebling. I would hesitate to define student individually myself. However, in my interpretation of what how I would read this, page 1, lines 9 through 12, substituting that entire section, benefiting the student individually. I understand the policy that higher education benefits society as a whole. K-12 education benefits society as a whole. In the context of financial aid here, rather than being financial aid that is given to an institution in order to help fund the institution and the students who go there, this would be something that is benefiting one student, so that person's state grant or North Star Promise. That's how I would read it. It is not a defined term in the statute, so I can't speak to the definition, but if this language passed as is, that's the interpretation I would have.
Thank you, Mr. Bold. Anything further, Chair Liebling? Okay. Thank you. So, any further discussion on the A2? Oh, Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. And, I brought a concern a couple of times about the language that's used in this, and I want an understanding for folks that are in process whether that meets the definition of not lawfully present. And I'll remind folks that Nonpartisan said, and I quote, we're not immigration attorneys. So I would really, I really thought we were going to get somewhere with this, Representative Schultz, after we spoke about how concerned I am about people, particularly students, I'm not allowed to call them kids, I get in trouble, that have SIJIS status. From the time they apply from SIJIS status until it is approved, does this bill take away their funding? Because my interpretation, based on the conversations I've had with immigration law attorneys, is that it would. And so I'm really concerned about telling sex trafficked victims and abused youth who have applied for SIJIS that they can't go to college. Can you help me understand why we're still using that language?
I will. Since it's not specific to the amendment, I would like to just adopt the amendment, make sure it gets in the order that we address 1.4. Okay. All right. Well, it is part of the larger conversation, however, so we try to move amendments quickly so that the bill is in the order the author wants. And I know, Chair Cleaborn, that's an effort you support as well. So I'm happy to have that conversation, but I do want to get through the amendment. Representative Hicks.
I absolutely, Chair. I respect your decision. I was hopeful that when there was an amendment that it would take into the considerations and the conversations that we had. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. So Representative Schultz, please respond briefly, and then let's try to get the amendment adopted, and then we'll have the larger conversation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill and this amendment is regards to people who have lawful status in the United States.
Thank you. And Chair Rarick, I see your hand up. Is this specific to the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Chair Rarick.
Just again for another point of clarification, if you look at the original fiscal note, they have pulled in competitive grants and legislatively named grants, which we don't want to include. And so this is the attempt to exclude those things. So a competitive grant might be the dual training grant, for example, or the Hunger Free Campus grants that go to institutions, or the legislatively named grants like Hennepin Healthcare Family Residency Programs. So, and the other thing I would say is OHE can probably explain the process that they already have in their application process to determine whether or not someone has legal standing. So if we want to go down that path after this amendment is adopted, we certainly can do that. OHE can come up and again explain how they determine whether or not someone has legal status or not. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. Any other discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
A2 is adopted. Thank you. Now, I would like to renew my motion that HF 1323, as amended, be referred to Ways and Means. All right. Now, is there any discussion on the bill before us? Yes, Representative Hicks.
I would like OE to come up and let's talk about how we define unlawfully present.
Thank you. Would someone from OE please come to the testifier table?
Chair Robbins, Representative Hicks. My name is Megan Flores, and I'm the manager of State Financial Aid Programs for the Office of Higher Education.
Thank you.
So I believe the question was how OHE defines unlawfully present.
No, I have very specific questions.
Okay.
Yes. Representative Hicks, why don't you restate your question so that she can provide a direct answer.
Thank you. Individuals who are in this country and are undocumented and who are youth and victims of sex crimes, trafficking, abuse, and have applied for SIJIS status, special immigrant juvenile status, from the time of application until issuance of that visa during that process, are they lawfully, legally here? And does this bill revoke the option for victims of torture and sex trafficking to attend higher education?
Representative Schultz, and then to the OHE testifier.
I can answer that one, absolutely. That doesn't impact them at all. This bill is in regards to financial aid. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So let's have...
It's not what I said.
It is what you said.
Chair Robbins, Representative Hicks, I can answer the question.
Thank you.
Applicants who have a T visa, which is a visa for victims of human trafficking, is separate than applicants who have special immigrant juvenile status, and I believe some of the members of the committee are confusing the two. A T visa applicant is a legally present status, and they are eligible to file the FAFSA, receive federal and state aid, if they meet the eligibility requirements. Special immigrant juvenile status is a status. It's not a visa itself. It's a classification that can lead to lawful permanent residency, as Representative Hicks describes. In that status, when they're in that, in between, they have to apply for an adjustment of status and be granted lawful permanent residency, commonly referred to as a green card. When that adjustment of status happens and is processed, adjudicated, then they do fall into the category of an eligible non-citizen and become eligible to apply for aid via the FAFSA. When they are in that in-between stage, those students have to apply for aid via the alternative student financial aid application because they are not eligible for federal financial aid. USCIS has publicly available information on their website that documents the backlog of approved special immigrant juvenile petitions that cannot apply for adjudication of status for lawful permanent residency status. And they have announced a deferred action policy for individuals who have the SIJ classification. USCIS is automatically considering SIJ beneficiaries for deferred action and accepting requests for renewal of deferred action within 6 months of expiration. If an individual is in that situation, they are under deferred action. Deferred action is a lawful presence status. And so someone with a lawful presence status who graduates from a Minnesota high school is eligible for state financial aid.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. That was incredibly helpful. We appreciate you being here and providing that clarity. Excellent. Any other discussion? Oh, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested and will be granted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, I just have one question for you, and don't worry, it's not a trick question like who is a Minnesotan. I'm curious, can you tell me the students that you would be kicking off of financial aid programs, or that your bill would, excuse me, what can you tell, what do you know about them as students, not, you know, related to immigration status or whatever, as students, what do you know about them?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A reminder that this bill is ensuring that American citizens and those who have lawful status in this country are able to receive a greater share of financial aid, and that we are not trying to take Minnesota taxpayer dollars and benefit folks who don't have that legal status here with their financial aid.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was not an answer to the question that I actually asked in there, which I think is intriguing, but I'll tell you what I know about them. And there's not a lot of Minnesota-specific data that I could find, but in the first 2 years of their college career, undocumented students, on average, have a higher GPA, they have a higher course completion rate, and they have actually a higher two-year degree completion rate than citizens, wherever they were born. And then after that first 2 years, they tend to fall off. And do you know why? And I'm not actually asking you the question. It's a rhetorical question. They fall off because states cut them off from financial aid. A lot of states don't do what we do. And what this bill would do is cut off the people who are some of the most hardworking, dedicated, and by multiple measures, some of the most successful students that we have. So even aside from whatever anyone may think about immigration policy or someone's immigration status, I cannot fathom why we would cut off some of our best students from having a successful college career. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Do you care to respond? Okay, Representative Novotny.
Representative Schultz, is there anything in your bill that would block a student that does not have legal status or is undocumented from attending a state college?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. No.
Representative Novotny.
Representative Schultz, I'll date myself, but say, for example, young me, just graduating college, did a year working in a factory before I decided to go to school, graduated in the top half of the bottom third of my class, and lived with my parents. And I wasn't blocked at any point from attending a community college or state college back then. Would there be anything as a legal status person born in the United States? Has anything changed in 40 years? Would I still be able to attend college?
Representative Schultz.
Yes.
What would change?
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. So what do we hear? I keep hearing about access. I keep hearing about all this. I know I work two jobs, three jobs in the summer to get money ahead. I don't remember any of the pitfalls stopping me from going to school because I wrote a check and they cashed my check. Would anything change with your bill? Would that still be possible with your bill?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. This bill provides everyone has the opportunity and the access to go to school. What this bill seeks to do is add eligibility requirements to ensure that Minnesota kids who have legal status here have more money for the state grant program and for the North Star Promise program. That's what this bill does. So for you, Representative Novotny, if this was you, you know, a couple years ago, in essence, this bill provides that you would have a little bit more money in your pocket.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Representative Schultz, and I intend to vote for this, probably.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I understand Representative Novotny's line of questioning, and as somebody who graduated within the last 20 years, at least, I think it's important that we like talk about what has changed in that time. For example, the cost of higher education has increased 42 times faster than inflation. Right, the cost of college has increased to the point where it costs, you know, more than my house. Like, I owe less on my mortgage than I do on my student loans because I came from a family that couldn't contribute anything, and as a single mom operating on one income raising kids alone, it was expensive. But that college opportunity provided me a pathway to stability to sit before you today. I'm a first-generation college graduate. Nobody in my family had ever been to college. My family's been in this country since the Mayflower arrived. Not a single person got a higher education until I did. That is meaningful. I'm able to break cycles for my children that they may have otherwise never been able to break. And that means that we'll have better social determinants of health all the way until I pass away, hopefully at a long old age with nice white hair, right? I'm hoping that my children will have better social determinants of health, will have lower crime rates, they'll have more opportunities to make more money in school. My daughter hasn't decided if she wants to go to college yet or not, but you know what? She's not a teen mom, and she's the first woman in our family to not be a teen mom in as many generations as we can count. And I highly attribute that to the fact that I was able to get a higher education. And when we cut people off from higher education in the ways that we're talking about it here, it means that you're making it inaccessible because it's unaffordable. And I mean, that's on the nose. I think that's an obvious thing. Every person here has door-knocked folks who've said college is too expensive. And that's what we mean when we say we cut off access. It doesn't mean they can't go or they're not allowed to anymore. It means that as a society, we are cutting off those opportunities for people who should have them because of the high cost of college. It is impossible to afford tuition without help for most people who go, particularly people who don't have silver spoons, who didn't come from trust funds, who don't have family generational wealth, who need that assistance. And that's not to say anything bad about the people who do have those things. It's just there's a lot of us who don't. And so when we talk about the folks that won't be able to access college, you know, where does it stop? If we start here and we cut off people who are some of our highest achieving students on campus, the next highest achieving students on campus are often student parents. Are we going to cut them off too in the terms of balancing a budget on their backs? I don't know. I don't know where we'll go. I don't have a crystal ball and I don't claim to. But I do think it's important that when we talk about losing access to college, it's because we're making it increasingly unaffordable. My daughter won't be able to, you know, if we don't have North Star Promise, if we don't find ways to also solve the budget problems we have, you know, she may not be able to go because my family does fit into that bracket. But there's a balance of having the conversation without having it on the backs of people's dignity. And I remember when you came into this committee, you said this is a conversation about dignity. So I'm going to bring us back to that point that you said and remember that we shouldn't talk about folks as if they're some drain on the economy, because by that sense, I'm the same drain, but I'm one of the most successful legislators from my community has ever seen, right? And that's a real thing. And it's specifically because of access to higher education that I was able to do this. And it was because our state grant programs were extended to people like myself and people who, you know, don't have the opportunities other people have. And people who are coming to this country or who were brought here as children don't have the same opportunities that other people tend to have. And I think I will always fight for those people. And that's what I want to bring to this conversation, is to remind us, especially the week that we're in right now, as we lead up to the next couple of weeks where a lot of people will be going to church to talk about how important that is to folks, I think it's important that we remember that we should welcome the stranger. And we've had this conversation before, and if it gets to the floor, we'll have it again, because it needs to happen. We either believe what we say we believe. We either believe the red words or we don't. We either apply that to our lives or we don't. We're either the hands and the feet or we're not. So.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Any response, Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And let's be very clear here. Just like you, Representative Hansen, I'm the first person in my family who has graduated from college, and you and I went to the exact same university. And I graduated from there. And I'll just say that when we come to this table, we hopefully have a respect for one another and understand that there has to be a priority around what we're going to do with the public's money. And that there is a difference, there is a clear difference between folks who have legal status, regardless of how they came here, in part because we don't have infinite amount of money. For Jenny, who sat here right next to me, from a family of immigrants, but they came here lawfully, there is no reason that she somehow should be treated on the same playing field as someone or a family that broke the law to come here.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Hansen, we have a couple more people on the list, and we do want to move to the other bills, so let's try to progress. Thank you.
But you know what? That other family, that is a child. And if we're going to talk about protecting kids, like, we cannot hold children accountable for, like, things their parents did. Like, they have no control over that. I have no control over the fact my parents didn't go to college any more than you did, right? And I will mention that same college that we went to, right, I was not allowed to continue going to that college because of who I am. And that's important. And I think, like, those are other conversations we can have other times. But that's the only reason I didn't graduate from that college. I went to a Catholic school after that, who welcomed me with open arms after that one made me leave. So I think there is not a difference between human beings. Dignity knows no difference. Human dignity knows no difference. And that's what we're taught. That's what we were taught. And I think you know that.
Thank you. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, can you speak to how this bill provides clarity and consistency for OHI when administering state-funded aid programs?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Duran. This provides clear guidance as to the eligibility requirements for the North Star Promise and for the state grant program. As you've heard from the testimony that they provided today, this makes it clear to them as to who is eligible for the state aid that we're talking about today and who does not.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that clarification. And I would also like to touch a little bit on the expensiveness of college. I am also the first person to graduate with a master's degree in my family, so I know how expensive college is. And it's a little concerning to me that we want to sit here and talk about affordability, but we know when we give state funding to programs that it just increases the cost for everybody. When we start supplementing programs, we start increasing the cost for everything. Plus, there's a lot of programs out there that realistically have a lot of, they're heavy on staff and the cost of administration. And we got people out there making hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to be professors. And, you know, most of them are kind of left-leaning, so why don't they pitch in a little bit less and make a little less money to help out with everybody else? I mean, there's lots of ways that we can go. But then also there's a lot of policies that we make in the state of Minnesota that make things more expensive in the state of Minnesota for us to operate. So this isn't just give money to a certain place to make it better for everybody. I think there's lots of things that we can do here in the state of Minnesota to lower cost for everything. But I think the wages that some of the people are making is quite high. And if we want to help out our students, I think we could all work on maybe bringing down those wages. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Duran. Any comment? No. Okay, Representative Cleburne, last at bat.
Thank you. And I want to kind of bring us back to why we're here today. The last time this bill was before the committee, we didn't have a fiscal note. So we're here today to review the fiscal note, to talk about it, and then to send it on to WAIS. I think that's the direction of the chair.
That is the path.
Okay, so in looking at the fiscal note does no longer matches the bill. So I don't know how we can make an informed decision. I mean, this is the third time we've heard the exact same bill, pretty much. And in all three times, we've not had a fiscal note that helped us make a sound financial determination. It would be my thought that we wait to hear this bill when we have a financial note that can truly inform our decision making. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. And I will note for the record that OHE got us the clean fiscal note and is someone here from OHE who would want to speak to that, the fiscal note? Look at that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and respond about the iterations of the fiscal note and where we're at the moment.
Okay, for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement for the Office of Higher Education. Understanding the conversation in committee, our agency requested the intention of the bill. Understanding the intention was just to apply to financial aid programs that are direct to individuals. For the cost of attendance, we updated the fiscal note. The LBO would not let us submit the updated fiscal note because the bill did not actually reflect that intent, and it needed to be clarified in the bill. I don't know what was talked about prior to, but I don't believe the amendment actually still gets at that. I think you might have to specify the exact programs that you're trying to have this apply to. But our updated fiscal note with the understanding of the intent had a zero cost because we would not send the money back to the general fund. It would just stay in each program.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. And I think we are all working in good faith on this. And so if you have language that you think needs to be added to provide the clarity we're talking about, I hope you will work with Representative Schultz on that and that we can get that cleaned up when it's before the Ways and Means Committee. All right. Oh, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. And that just further adds to my concern, right, that the bill isn't quite ready yet and that we need to, I mean, what's the rush? We are going to be gone for a week away from the Capitol doing work in our constituencies or whatever. What's the rush? I mean, it's a financial bill that's going to go to Ways and Means. I don't understand the rush.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. I think we've vetted, as you pointed out, this bill several times, and we've heard testimony from OHE that the new fiscal note will reflect zero costs. And so we do have the data. We just don't have the updated fiscal note that we are expecting any day. So we look forward to letting Ways tie the bow on this thing. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. And I think OHE is awesome. They do great work. And I have a great appreciation for Ms. Oliver. But we also heard the amendment doesn't do what we are being told it will do. Therefore, the fiscal note if this amendment that was just put on the bill doesn't do what we're being told it's going to do, then where are we with this bill? And it's our responsibility to make sure bills are right before we send them on, saying yes, we'll spend the money, or no, we won't.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let's level set just here. Just a minute. Yes, we've heard this bill three times. And in the fiscal note you have in front of you, it actually has a savings to the state grant program and the North Star Promise program of just shy of $3 million. We have $131 million shortfall, a structural deficit in the state grant program alone. There's another projected shortfall coming in North Star Promise. Again, we have a structural deficit that we've created. We don't know how to prioritize in this committee, to be quite honest. And here's just yet another example of we got priorities all over the board. So this is one example that we could pass today. I can tell you exactly what the fiscal note will say when it comes back, because I have those numbers, and it's a zero additional cost with a cost savings to the state grant program and other programs, including North Star Promise and a few other things, of about $2.5 million. So somewhere between $2.5 and $2.9 million will be saved just in fiscal year 27. You have the $2.9 in front of you right now. The only difference is going to be that there will be no cost to OHE, and they certainly can come up and talk about that. If we need one more small adjustment to make this work, we can certainly do that in Ways and Means. We do it all the time. I've been here for over a decade. This is my 14th year. We do this kind of stuff all the time. We've talked about this three times. We can pass it today to Ways and Means, do the final amendment there, get the final fiscal note there, and be able to save the state grant program and other programs be somewhere between $2.5 and $2.9 million. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, we are now going to proceed with the motion. I'm sorry. We're all set. Okay. Yes, there is a roll call. So with that, I renew my motion to pass HF 1323 as amended to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Roll call.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Robbins.
Aye.
Chair Wolgamott.
No.
Vice Chair Schwartz. Aye. Vice Chair Coulter.
Oh, God, no.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Duran.
Yes.
Representative Hansen.
Absolutely not.
Representative Hicks?
No.
Representative Cleburne?
Cleburne, no.
Representative Liebling?
Liebling, no.
Representative Knorr?
Once again, no.
Representative Novotny?
Reflecting House rules, I will vote without further comment other than yes.
Representative Rarick?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Thank you, members. 7 in favor, 7 against. The motion does not prevail, and we will lay HF 1323 over. Next up, we have HF 4266 from Representative Allen. We will be sending this bill to Ways and Means. Since we've already heard this bill, we will not be taking any new public testimony. Welcome, Representative Allen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Co-Chair Wolgamont. We're bringing back the bill for the 4266. The bill's name is Lowest Recognized Family Responsibility Amount Modified for Purpose of Determination State Grant Awards. When we last discussed this bill, we were waiting on a fiscal note from OHE. We have finally received that fiscal note, which should be in your packets. And at this point in time, no sense in, I guess, going back over everything all over again and rehashing it out. I guess I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont.
Madam Chair, I don't have a question, but I would like to request a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested, will be granted. Representative Coulter.
I'm sorry, side conversation. So my first question, Madam Chair, I guess maybe this was not clear, but I understand the motion is to send this to Ways and Means. My understanding was that kind of it wasn't like an official rule, but that we weren't going to do sort of one-off bills that affect the state grant, that we were going to, that because of the way different choices and different levers affect awards, that we weren't necessarily sending out individual bills that do individual things to the state grant program. I guess I didn't ask a question there. I'm just kind of confused as to why the motion is to send this to the Ways and Means Committee rather than have a discussion and lay it over and include that in the broader discussion about what we're going to do with the state grant program.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. I think maybe there's some confusion about that understanding. So I think that is what your side wanted to proceed with, but our side wants to move bills. So we will proceed. We will continue to have these conversations about the state grant, but this is probably the largest lever we have on this, or one of the largest. And so we've had thorough discussion of it. It's in the governor's recommendation, and we hope we can get support for it from both sides of the aisle to move this on to Ways and Means.
I do actually have a question.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I'm not sure personally that's good policy, but I'll move on. My question is, I think, for OHE, because it's about the fiscal note.
Would someone from OHE be able to join us at the testifier table?
I haven't actually asked the question yet, so maybe that's on me.
It's regarding the fiscal note.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver.
Yeah,
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can ask the question and we can pinch it as needed. So I'm looking at page 5 on the fiscal note at the top. It says, an estimated 500 students would lose state grant awards in fiscal year 2027 due to this change. Does that reflect the rationing that has already occurred, or does that assume sort of pre-rationing what the state of play was for the state grant program?
Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I think Nicole will be best to answer that, but if we're, we did the fiscal note based on the change in the bill, and with rationing is my assumption, because we can't do a fiscal note based on laws that haven't changed. So I believe it incorporates the rationing and the change to the SAI.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so I want to make sure I understand this then. So then, what this bill would do is, yeah, perhaps Ms. Whalen would be the one to answer this. So assuming the rationing as it currently exists stays constant, am I reading this correctly, that we change this bill and 500 fewer students get a state grant award?
Ms. Whalen, please state your name for the record and proceed to answer the question.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. For the record, my name is Nicole Whalen, and I am the State Grant Research Manager at the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. So the answer to your question is a little complicated. Because we are running numbers in a year in which we have already announced rationing, for the purposes of state grant, and I would say any fiscal note and the governor's budget recommendations that have come across this committee, all of the numbers start with the assumption that the state grant is not rationed, if that makes sense, because the parameters that we announced are mandatory estimated parameters. They are not parameters that are in state statute. So I start with the assumption that state grant is unrationed, then I apply the change, and then I apply estimated rationing after the change has been made to further reflect, you know, the remaining gap between spending and appropriations. So in the case of this bill, that number 500 is specifically the impact of that change. There were 500 fewer students who would qualify for a state grant using that change. However, with estimated rationing that would have to be applied on top of that change in order to bring the program within appropriations for the biennium, an estimated total of around 12,000 students would not qualify for awards. I would have to look at my numbers for a comparison of how many students are estimated to lose awards under the current rationing outline, but I believe it is a fairly comparable number.
Thank you, Ms. Whalen. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I'm going to try asking this in a slightly different way just to make sure. So that 500 number that that would reflect the law, if that would reflect the state grant program if this change were made, and then the rationing took place to sort of bring the state grant program into balance. Am I correct in that understanding?
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that the 500 student reduction is really the isolated impact of just this change. Then there would be additional rationing needed on top of that change. And that rationing is not in addition to the parameters we've already announced, but it's what the revised parameters would be.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, thank you for working through that with me. I just wanted to make sure I understood this. So, I guess the way I read this then is that we make this change and at least 500 fewer students would receive a state grant award based under this bill. And, I understanding, of course, the purpose is to reduce spending. The purpose is to reduce the budget for the state grant program. And so I think we just need to be very clear about that fact that 500 fewer students would get an award. And additionally, because this change specifically affects our lowest income students, it is, in essence, for lack of a better phrase, a transfer of wealth from our poorest, our neediest students into higher income folks who qualify for the state grant program. So that is my comment on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Any further discussion? Representative Knorr.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to follow up on the question about this spending. So if there's a shift of the 500 students, I see also on the fiscal note, 575 will be applying or eligible for the North Star Promise Act. So we're putting the pressure on the North Star Promise Act, which will deplete that funding. Is that correct?
Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is correct. The fiscal note does also indicate a shift of 570 students receiving North Star Promise grants that previously were not estimated to do so. So that would increase spending for the North Star Promise program. That number, 570 students, assumes
assumes the existing priority deadline of June 1st, 2026 for North Star Promise.
Thank you, Ms. Whalen. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Member. So we're just doing shifting, not balancing the whole process. So I think this formula doesn't work for the students because we're not addressing the core issue here. We've got a budget shortfall. We need to make sure that we use all the opportunity to find the resources needed to support the students. So I don't think this formula is something that I'm interested in.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And so this question is for the author then. Given what Chair Noor just shared, can you help us understand the rationale for this bill?
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen. The rationale for the bill is to be able to make sure that the program stays around for the people that it actually need it in perpetuity, for those the individuals like me when I was going through, and my wife when we were going through, that it's there in order to be able to help students. It's not necessarily taking anything away from the ability for people to apply for North Star or any of the other scholarships and grants that are currently sitting out there. It's just making sure that we can keep this program in place for individuals in the near term. And like stated before, the idea is that this gives the OHE the ability, if there is a surplus, they have the ability to be able to go back in and award more dollars to those students that need it later on.
Chair, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer, Representative Allen. So can I count on your support to help us fund more money into North Star Promise, since you'll be shifting some folks over there?
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for the question. At this point in time, we're focusing on this particular bill that's in front of us. I can't speak to North Star because that's not anything that we're currently looking at with this particular bill, ma'am.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you again. But again, you know, highlighting what Chair Noor just shared with us, like, your bill just does a shift in practice. And so I think it is, like, holistic and responsible of us to talk about that, because when you're just moving, you know, 500 off of state grant and then 575 are moving on to North Star Promise, first of all, you know, people who lose access to state grant, you know, maybe may or may not, you know, eligibility can change and all of that. But I mean, we're also then losing tuition. Our enrollment goes down. I mean, more than likely, if you're not able to get that assistance. And I thought the mission of this committee, because Chair Pawlowski would tell me so, that we are to get enrollment up. And that's what we're supposed to be focused on, because that is, like, the bigger mission of this committee, is to make sure we're honoring our state budget and educating the next generation of people. So I guess, again, my question for you was, you know, if I were to drop a bill this year that said that I wanted to compensate for that additional funds that are going to be moving to North Star Promise, could I count on your support?
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Hansen. I would have to actually see the bill first to be able to see the language, and quite honestly, we got to figure out where we're going to be able to get the money from to be able to do it. When we take a look at where things are currently looking at as far as the fiscal situation our state is in, we have to find a way to be able to pay for things.
Thank you. All right, Representative Rarick, last one, and then we got to get to a vote here. You're muted.
Yep, sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thought I hit it. So again, let's just summarize this really quickly. We have $131 million shortfall. We've created a structural imbalance because we just threw open the gates and said, just come and we'll pay for all your college. And they came because it's free college. So we don't have new money. If I would be more than happy to work with the other side of the aisle to cut programs and prioritize money for the state grant program and for North Star Promise, that'd be a joy. We tried that exercise last session. I had over $130 million of cuts that the Republicans were willing to make. And we got a little teeny tiny bit of cuts from the other side. So I'm all ears. Let's look at where we can prioritize the money that we have. We're not getting new money unless you've got some money in couch cushions I don't know about. So the only way we can close this gap is either changing the levers, which is what this is doing, or we have to cut programs and reallocate that money into the state grant program. That's it. Those are our choices. We're not getting new money. So if anybody wants to work with me on those two things, I am more than happy to work with you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. So Representative Allen renews his motion that HF 4266 be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. There will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Robbins.
Aye.
Chair Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes no.
Vice Chair Schwartz.
Aye.
Vice Chair Coulter.
No.
Representative Allen.
Allen votes aye.
Representative Duran.
Aye.
Representative Hansen.
No.
Representative Hicks. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, no.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Noor.
Nope.
Representative Nemotny.
Yes.
Representative Rarick.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
There being seven ayes and six nays, the motion passes.
Madam Chair, point of order.
Oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't. Sorry. I was reading it backwards. So we need a majority to get it out of the committee, just explaining for the public, so that's why it failed, and we are laying it over for possible inclusion. Representative Allen. Representative Allen moves to bring up HF 4413 and bring it from the table, and we intend to send this to the General Register. Representative Allen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Wolgamott. I think we all have a certain amount of frustration after experiencing going through the selection of regents last year with the University of Minnesota. I want to thank everybody for the amount of time that was put in by members doing interviews and the amount of staff time that went into that process. It really does give everybody a better understanding of how the process is intended to work and what goes on as we are trying to select regents. HF 4413 is a good government bill that addresses the gap in the University of Minnesota Board of Regents selection process. Under current law, the Joint Legislative Committee interviews, recommends candidates for the Board of Regents. Then the legislature meets in a joint convention to elect regents from the recommended list. However, if the legislature does not elect a candidate to fill that particular vacancy, the governor can step in and appoint someone to fill that particular seat. We ran into last year was a situation where several regents were appointed by the governor who never went through the legislative vetting process and were never interviewed or recommended by the Joint Legislative Committee. Regardless of party, that raises concerns about transparency and the legislature's role in the regents, the selection of the regents. This simply closes the gap. The bill does not remove the governor's authority to fill vacancies. What it does is it requires that if a governor makes appointments, that appointment must come from a pool of candidates that were already vetted and recommended by the Joint Legislative Committee. So anybody who ends up serving as a regent, whether elected by the legislature or appointed by the governor, must go through that same public vetting process. This bill really is about transparency, accountability, and maintaining the legislature's role in the regent selection process. It ensures there's no end arounds the legislative vetting process while preserving the governor's ability to fill vacancies when needed. I would ask for your support, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. First, we're going to move to our testifier, Mr. Luther. Could you come to the testifier table? You have 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, members. My name is William Luther. I'm the Director of State Affairs for the Undergrad Student Government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm also a current junior at the College of Liberal Arts. I'm here to testify on House File 4413. The Region Candidate Advisory Council, RCAC, is one of the few ways students, staff, legislators, and alumni can ask questions of future Regents candidates. Last year, many candidates were asked about their positions on key university issues and where they want to see the university go in the future, including tuition increases, student basic needs, and adapting to future workforce needs. The open and transparent process is what these future regents will experience once they become members of our Board of Regents. However, the legislature did not elect regents last year. Only two of the four appointed regents went through RCAC. What's disappointing about this process is that some of the regents appointed did not have to field questions from students, staff, alumni, and legislators. The process completely lacked any student input. In the future, we want this process to be as transparent as possible. Although we support House File 4413's goal, we'd like to see this bill to be changed where all candidates that got approved through RCAC can be eligible or be appointed by the governor, not just what the legislature recommended. Our university, I'll just end with this, our university is attended by students across all 87 counties of our state. It is the largest public university in our state. It educates thousands of students, including future writers, lawyers, teachers, healthcare workers, farmers, researchers, business people, and legislators. Our university is made up of the staff and professors who both teach and care for our university, the students who are taught by them to become the future change makers in our state and nation, and the alumni who bear our name as they blaze that future. It's students, alumni, staff, and legislators who should have a say in who leads our university system. Please keep in mind student voices when considering this legislation and make the Regent Candidate Advisory Council something where students can have a more active voice in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Luther. Is there any discussion? Otherwise, we'll move to vote. Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing this, Representative Allen. Even though I've been in the legislature a long time, this is my first term on higher ed, and I've always found this regional election process absolutely mind-boggling. I've never understood it, and I've never been close to the inside of how it works either. So I appreciate you bringing this up, and I kind of share the concern, of course, that the bill is getting at. But I, especially listening to the testifier, I have concerns about this, because especially like what happens if the Joint Legislative Committee doesn't pick candidates? I mean, that can happen. I do think that he's onto something about having a wider pool, you know, restricting the governor somewhat so he can't just take, you know, his uncle or something. I'm fine with that. But, you know, having a wider pool of people who've been vetted, that the public has had an opportunity to know who they are and so on, I'd like to see something a little broader than what's here. So I feel a little bit on the fence. Could you speak to that?
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, and thank you for the question, Representative Liebling. You and me both share the same experience on this because, for me, it was my first time doing this as well. And I can note as an alumni of the University of Minnesota, there was a certain amount of frustration that I felt going through college with how the process was ran, and I can echo a lot of the sentiments the young man that was up here testifying on behalf of this. I think we can all agree that transparency is the biggest thing that we're particularly looking for with this bill. That you're right, it's difficult to watch when individuals are plucked out that never went through the process. No one ever had the opportunity to be able to vet them publicly and see exactly where they stand on a lot of the issues, especially when it comes to this institution that really is critical to a lot of the things that happen within the state of Minnesota. I think he brought up some extremely good points, and we can work through a potential amendment to that if that's something that's workable. So,
thank you, Chair Cleavorn. I'm sorry, you're next, Chair Cleavorn. Chair Liebling.
thank you, Madam Chair. And so this is going to the General Register, I think. It does limit our opportunity a little bit on that. And I just wanted to make it really clear that by, you know, saying, you know, the governor can't appoint his brother-in-law or his uncle, this is not about a current governor.
No.
Because what we pass here is about every governor and going forward in the process. So I just want to make that really clear. It could be a Republican governor, you like or don't like the governor, you like or don't like who he appoints. It doesn't matter. It's really about whether the process is appropriate so that there are enough eyes and enough input on who's being selected. So, so you're committing that you this might not be the final form of the bill then, that as we move forward?
Representative Allen.
I think we're open to making a modification to it or an amendment to it potentially.
Yeah, I would encourage you to work together and with the testifier, and we could do a floor amendment.
Yes.
Chair Cleavorn.
Thank Thank you. And this question is for Mr. Hopkins, please.
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Hopkins, you know that I have gone back and forth about what we can constitutionally do with the university and mm-hmm. what we can constitutionally do with the governor's choices. So the words on line 1.11 that say may only, does may only translate to must?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleavorn, so the intent of the bill is to constrain the governor's ability in selecting his own nominees for a vacancy. So, yes, if the issue is that the Joint Committee has in the past recommended more than one candidate for a single vacancy, mm-hmm. so in that situation, the governor would have an option between two candidates.
Chair Cleavorn.
Right. I appreciate that, but I'm just trying to understand if may only, if we took may only out and inserted must, would we have this, would it be the exact same outcome?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleavorn, technically no. I suppose the governor could choose not to nominate someone to fill the vacancy.
Chair Cleavorn.
That's an interesting twist. Thank you for that. Okay, now may I?
Yes, Chair Cleavorn.
Thank you. Representative Allen, I've been on higher ed for four terms, and all four terms I tell people this is the wackiest ride you will ever go on, and I will never commit to supporting you because I have no idea how it's going to end. So I have to wait to the end, see who my candidates are, and mm-hmm. then figure it out. I really appreciate the intent of this bill. And I also heard Mr. Luther, and I think his recommendation is also good. I want to make sure that when we're working with what the legislature says the executive must do or mm-hmm. may only do is constitutional, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I can't say. And then what process we lock the university into, because the university is also constitutionally independent of us. So putting this into statute causes me some pause, but would I agree with you 100% we need some revision of this process? I do. So I'm happy to be a willing partner in this work, but I don't think I can support this right now as it's written. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. Did you care to comment, Representative Allen?
No, I would thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cleavorn, I would echo those sentiments too. It is an extremely wacky process, and it's, you know, just like many in this room, we all sat down and met with these individuals, we vetted them, and tried to figure out what was the best path forward for the U of M, and it was very frustrating when it ended up going outside of the individuals that we were talking to. And that's the other thing that was more frustrating is these were individuals that applied to do this, right? They got involved with the region, or the process of going through this, which is not the friendliest thing in the world to do for them. They wanted to be there for the best of intentions, and then there's individuals selected from outside the group that really were there and wanted to do it. So it was.
Thank you. Very quickly, Chair Cleavorn. We have many more names, and we got a lot of bills to get through here.
Oh, thank you. I might suggest that we think about the whole process differently, maybe. Mm-hmm. So we have boards and commissions that go through the Secretary of State's posting, and then again, because there are public individuals who put their names into the selection pool, we may need to think about just how we do it. Instead of trying to build on a broken foundation, we might need to just start fresh. I'll say it that way and then stop. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rarick, Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let's just think about how we got here. So we had gone through the entire process at the legislature, short of the actual election, the joint convention where we have the House and the Senate come together to do the final elections. And the only reason that that didn't happen is because I couldn't get agreement from my co-chair on the other side to make that happen. The Senate was on board. I got the Senator Fitte over there, all we got the letter signed, we got the whole process started, and then we hit a brick wall. So this wasn't by accident. It wasn't we ran out of time. It was because this was a willful decision that they wanted the governor
motive,
to elect.
Please, we must not impugn motive.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
I'm telling, I have the floor. We don't do that in committee. So
Madam Chair, point of order.
Yes, we do.
State your point, Chair Wolgamott.
Madam Chair, let's avoid evoking motives of other members of this committee and have a respectful conversation about the bill before us, which is Representative Allen's House File 4413, and please contain our remarks to that bill and refrain from evoking my motives or the motives of any member of this committee.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. I would remind everyone that we do not impugn motives of members. We are here to talk about the bill. And Chair Rarick, you have the floor, and I'm imploring people to please move along. We still have other testifiers or other people who want to ask questions, and we have so many bills to get through. Please, Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we hit a brick wall, and the governor got to a point. And he appointed two people that hadn't gone through the whole process. That's why we have this bill here today. So I decided to look into who are these two people, because they didn't go through the process and I had no idea who they were. So the first person he picked was Joel Bergstrom. Then I did a little search to see who Joel Bergstrom was. And it turns out he bought a home in October of 23, with a woman by the name of Ann O'Connor. Now, who's Ann O'Connor? Ann O'Connor happens to be the governor's deputy chief of staff for cabinet affairs.
Okay. Madam
so
Chair, point of parliamentary inquiry.
Highest ranking person in the governor's office. And then I
Madam Chair, what order of business are we on?
Madam Chair, then I looked at the second person.
Sorry, my mic wasn't on. Chair Wolgamott had a point of order. He asked for the
point of parliamentary inquiry.
The point of parliamentary inquiry is what line of business are we on? And we are on the motion to send HF 4413 to the General Register. And Chair Rarick has the floor, and she is talking about the bill, because it's relevant to how the regent selection process went last time around. But please wrap it up, Chair Rarick, because we do need to move on.
Right. So again, since everybody was yelling, I'll restate it really quickly. So the Joel Bergstrom bought a house and is in a personal relationship with the governor's now deputy chief of staff for cabinet affairs, who was running his office, according to a MinnPost article, when he was running for when he was running with Harris. So the second person that the governor decided to appoint is a man by the name of Samuel Hines, whose wife is Stacy Lynn Mills, and they have a law firm together, as was stated in the press release. And combined, those two folks since 2009 have donated to mostly Democrats, I think exclusively Democrats, a total of $380,776.
So Madam Chair, point of order.
This is what we would have.
State your point, Chair Wolgamott.
Madam Chair, the remarks and debate must pertain to House File 4413. This is a bill about the region appointment process going forward. It is not a bill to dive into people's personal lives or impugn motives or anything like that. Can we please, we have limited time in our committee, we have a number of bills left on the agenda, rather than rehashing things out, can we please keep the remarks limited to the bill before us, House File 4413?
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Just a moment, I'm going to respond to that. So Chair Wolgamott, I take your point. Representative Rarick is laying out a case of why this bill is necessary, so it is relevant. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And she's stating the facts. She's stating why. She's making the case for why the status quo is not a good idea, to just let the governor make some choices, because the point she's making is a very valid point. If it goes to any sort of cronyism or anything like that, we want to avoid that. That's why we have the bill here. She's building the case. So it would be great. We would move along further if there were fewer interruptions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So, Chair Novotny, do you want to speak to this, or are you?
Very short.
Very short. Chair Novotny.
Representative Allen, thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a very important bill. I look at the time that just the members alone spend speaking to these candidates. It's vital. I have no idea why a person would put themselves up to be a regent for what it goes through. That being said, the regents that we do have are vital. They have so much responsibility. They control so many things. And I think that the people of the state should pick the regents, not the governor. The governor's not a king. And for that reason, I request a roll call.
Roll call having been requested will be granted. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just wanted to ask nonpartisan Mr. Hopkins, when does the governor get involved in selecting, and for what, how long? Is it temporary or is it permanent?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, if there's a vacancy if there's a continuing vacancy on the Board of Regents and the legislature has adjourned without having an election to fill that vacancy and the vacancy persists, then the governor has an opportunity to nominate someone. If the legislature returns for a subsequent session and elects someone, then there's no more vacancy for the governor to fill. So as long as the vacancy persists, the governor could fill it.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Exactly. The reason why we have this bill is because we failed as legislators.
That's right.
And we can't be blaming the executive branch for actions that they took because we failed, whether we negotiated in good faith between the Senate and the House and to have that convention to elect regents. So failure of legislature is not a problem for the executive branch. And having this bill is only going to persist because we have seen that us collectively, we have appointed individuals who were never recommended by the Joint Legislative Committee. So are we going to also bind the body, the House, that we should never, ever select anyone who has not been recommended by the ARCAC or the Joint Legislative Committee so that we do have a clear picture? If we can tell the governor this is how you should follow, why not even bind the legislative body to do the same so that we don't have people appointed outside the ARCAC, outside the Joint Legislative Committee appointment? This is just trying to search for a solution where there's no problem. It's our responsibility to select, elect, and have a convention because the Constitution separates us. That's why we do have the joint convention, because the University of Minnesota as a land grant existed before the state, so we have to do that. So likewise, I think this bill does not solve the problem. We need to solve the problem internally to get to the solution we're looking for. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Representative Hansen, and then we'll go to you, Chair Wildeman.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Allen, for bringing this. What an interesting conversation we're having here. And who knew your first round of opinions about the regents process would bring you to this point. So was it the regents process that was frustrating or this one? We shall never know. Chicken or the egg, right? So I have quite a few questions now because I have participated in this process my whole time here, all three terms that I've been in the legislature. And, you know, there's lots of really big feelings out there about ARCAC and should they have influence? I say yes, just for the record. I think that there's a lot of things that have been brought up, like Chair Rarick brought up here. So I'm wondering, I know this is going to the general register, but I can't help but wonder if this committee needs to maybe get on the same page before we recommend this to the rest of our body, given the comments that have been made here today. So if you're open to that, I will not make the motion, but I would ask you in good faith to potentially make that motion yourself in order to let this team work together to flesh some of this out. And as such, I would ask you to consider a few things that we've heard here today. So I would be wondering if you'd be willing to limit things to specifically who can go through that legislative process. Should there be eligibility requirements for that folks? Should we limit the business interests that these folks have? Should we limit the personal relationships that people have? Should we limit the eligibility based on any leadership positions they've had at a Fortune 50 or 500 company here in Minnesota? Should we limit those relationships whether or not they've dated, slept with, or been with a legislator before? Or if they have worked with anybody in the office in the same sort of situation? Are those all considerations that we should be making? Because
given what's been brought up here today, it seems like there's some interest in limiting what that eligibility should look like in order to avoid maybe a potential bias or not above board selections, as have been accused. But I think that we would have to remember then that this would not just apply to this administration, but to everyone going forward. And so I hope that we would add a lens to this, with a nonpartisan lens to this, or maybe a very partisan lens to this, you could pick, I guess, and say that we should consider, you know, does this mean that if we have a legislative body that's run by Republicans and a Democratic governor, do they have to take party into consideration? And vice versa, would a Republican governor then never be able to, would they be required essentially to appoint a progressive? I would like to see a bill that reflects all of those things going forward. I think this conversation's been very, very enlightening, and I have a whole lot of new ideas that I think we should talk about. So if you would like to chat about this, I'm happy to do that. Mm-hmm. But I do think that we should talk about what other options we should limit if we're going to talk about bringing these things up about who was selected through the process that stands today. I think we should apply that same logic to ourselves here as well. Thank you.
Any response, Representative Allen?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Robbins and Representative Hansen. I think if we take a look at the bill, it's not necessarily limiting it's not limiting the individuals that can apply, right? All we're looking at it from the standpoint is that the individuals that we vet that put themselves forward, that are willing to go through this entire process, that put themselves forward to be able to do this, those are the individuals that the governor is going to potentially be selecting from, right? And it just adds a level of transparency to it that the public is going to be able to see who these individuals are. They're going to be able to look through the entire process. And whether it's a Republican governor, a Democrat governor, or as we had with Ventura, an independent governor, that those individuals are going to have to narrow their focus specifically to the people that we actually had an opportunity to the public see vetted and actually hear. And I'm very open to making an amendment if we do get this to the general register, making an amendment on at the floor in order to be able to kind of include some of those ideas from the university or the student body over at the University of Minnesota, just to actually include that on. So I would love to try to work through that entire process and see if we have the ability to be able to do it. So.
Thank you. Quickly, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. I was with you on this. I was there. I was there with you. I think you could have got this to the floor today. At least, I can't speak for my other people how they're going to vote. But Chair Rarick really brought up some ideas that I'm interested in actually pursuing. And like, I think you should see my notes over here. I'm going all over the place with this, right? It's fair. Let's talk about it. I think that this is actually something we should continue to flesh out. And I have now changed my mind on where I'm at on this. So I think the discussion's been good. I love committee work. And as long as you want to keep this here and keep talking about it, I'm here for it.
Thank you. Representative Allen removes his motion that we will now send HF 4413 to the floor. A roll call has been called and requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Robbins.
Aye.
Chair Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes no.
Vice Chair Schwartz.
Aye.
Vice Chair Coulter.
No.
Representative Allen.
Aye.
Representative Duran. Representative Hansen.
No.
Representative Hicks.
No.
Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, no.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Noor.
No.
Representative Novotny.
Yes.
Representative Burke.
Absolutely yes.
Representative Scott.
Vote being 7 ayes, 7 nays, it does not move on to the general register, and we are laying it on the table. With that, Representative Reimer, welcome to the committee to present HF 3101, and your testifiers can be joining you at the table. So on behalf of Representative Ryer, I move the bill And our intention is to send this on to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Meyer, please state your name and present your bill.
Madam Chair, that is what I'd like to do with the bill. My name is Max Reimer. Thank you all for joining us here. Thank you, Chair and Co-Chair Wolgamott, for the opportunity to present House File 3101. I want to keep my remarks brief because we have a lot of good supporting testimony for why this bill is necessary. House File 3101 creates an Intellectual Freedom Protection Act, which creates a viewpoint neutrality at our public post-secondary institutions. This bill is based on the simple principle: public colleges and universities shouldn't require students or faculty to adopt specific political or ideological beliefs as a condition of admission, employment, promotion, or access to benefits. Because they are public institutions, these are government actors, and the government shouldn't be in a position of compelling speech or ideological statements. To be clear about what this bill doesn't do, it doesn't prohibit diversity, equity, or inclusion programs, and it doesn't restrict what can be actually taught in the classroom. There's a transparency component to this bill, as well as an enforcement mechanism to this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions about this bill, but I do want to leave time for my testifiers today. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Breyer. First up, we have Tyler Coward. Please come and state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tyler Coward. I'm lead counsel for Government Affairs at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the free speech rights of all Americans. And we rise today in support of HF 3101. Fostering a welcoming, discrimination-free environment in our colleges and universities helps students of all backgrounds have the chance to succeed. Academic institutions across the country have given this as their reason for investing millions of dollars in diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, programs. Unfortunately, some of these DEI offices have too often strayed from this noble purpose by inappropriately injecting themselves and their political perspectives into discussions of curriculum, as well as faculty hiring, reappointment, evaluation, promotion, or tenure decisions. No matter how well-intentioned, these ideological impositions on critical aspects of higher education are a step too far and often undermine the very goals they seek to accomplish. And across the country, a lot of universities have adopted mandatory DEI statements. The typical DEI statement policy is not concerned merely with the faculty members' relevant scholarship or the laudable goal of ensuring faculty remain free from that faculty do not discriminate in their work toward the success of all students, regardless of their identity. Many policies invade faculty members' freedom of conscience, prying on into their private beliefs on matters of public concern. They compel faculty to express or demonstrate commitment to the university's viewpoints, or to conform their pedagogy, research, or services to specific ideological perspectives. For instance, at Texas Tech University, public records revealed that biology department adopted a policy to require and strongly weight diversity statements from all candidates, resulting in numerous instances in which candidates were screened before even being evaluated on their competencies about biology, whether or not they had a statement that was sufficiently diverse. One candidate's evaluation notes that he mentioned DEI is not an issue because he respects his students and treats them all equally.
Mr. Coward. We need you to wrap it up.
Okay, this was a long testimony, so I'll just say that when used at public universities, these DEI statements are constitutionally dubious at best. There's a long line of Supreme Court case law, including West Virginia versus Barnett, which prohibits compelled speech. In academic freedom cases, including Sweezy versus New Hampshire, that says that the essentiality of freedom in the American community of American universities is almost self-evident. No one should underestimate the vital role in a democracy that is played by those who guide and train our youth. To impose any straitjacket upon the intellectual leaders in our colleges and universities would imperil the future of the nation.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Colleen Lindgren.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Colleen Lindgren. I'm a senior state policy manager for the Pacific Legal Foundation, and we're a nonprofit public interest law firm that represents clients free of charge around the country in a variety of constitutional cases, including cases dealing with equality under the law and the 14th Amendment. And we're devoted to dismantling unconstitutional barriers to opportunity and upholding the promise of the 14th Amendment. And in respect to time, I'm going to keep my remark very short because I want my colleague to be able to speak about an issue that's came up here in Minnesota recently. But I'll just say that we have a long history of challenging the constitutionality of laws that include gender or race-based classifications in things like public contracting or school admissions or appointments to public boards, because these classifications perpetuate stereotypes and reduce individuals to mere groups. And so we're really grateful for you considering House File 3101 and for Representative Reimer to bringing this bill. We believe it promotes equality by ensuring students, employees, and other individuals are not required by institutions of higher education to espouse or adhere to certain viewpoints about others based on immutable characteristics. This is unconstitutional, and Minnesota is not alone in taking steps to protect against this. In the letter that we submitted, we listed states. There are 11 states since California kind of kicked off this trend, so to speak, in 1996. There are 11 states that have introduced various similar reforms. And this reform is also in line with stipulations that the state of Minnesota made in a recent case that we litigated on behalf of an individual here. And so I'd like to give the rest of my time to my colleague Brandon to discuss that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brandon Beyer, and I'm an attorney for Pacific Legal Foundation. The 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause requires that the government treat citizens as individuals, not as mere components of racial or ideological class. The Supreme Court recently reaffirmed this in Students for Fair Admission v. Harvard when they said eliminating discrimination means eliminating all of it. This bill before you codifies that well-established precedent by ensuring that admissions to or employment at Minnesota's public institutions isn't conditioned on ideological prejudice or racial or ethnic identities. Kylene mentioned it. In 2024, we filed suit to challenge a Minnesota law that imposed a racial quota for the Board of Social Work in the state. That law, which is still on the books, requires at least 5 board members to be from a community of color, effectively disqualifying qualified Minnesotans based solely on their skin color. In April 2025, the District Court of Minnesota favorably dismissed that case after the governor jointly stipulated with us that he may not consider race or limit the pool of qualified applicants for appointments. The governor has acknowledged that these race-based requirements are violative of state and federal law, including the Equal Protection Clause. This bill before you simply brings our higher education institutions into alignment with this established precedent. Public service on higher education should be open to all qualified citizens based on their individual merit, not their adherence to a specific ideology or their immutable characteristics. We urge the committee to support this bill to protect intellectual freedom and equality for all Minnesotans. Thank you for your time. We're happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. We'll now move to member discussion. Great. Seeing, oh, Chair Noor.
thank you, Madam Chair. To the author of the bill, the question is because we understand from research that individuals who benefit from having someone from the same background will help them succeed in higher education, for example. Will this bill limit that ability to have that freedom of having individuals who are going to be able to help particularly minority community to succeed in higher education? Will this bill prohibit those hiring practices?
Representative Reimer.
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, thank you for the question. No, I don't think so, because ultimately when you determine hiring based on merit, I would assume if there's specific cultural pockets that we want to focus on in the university system, I would want to hire the person who has the most experience in that specific group. It's less about a racial quota and more about what kind of experience do you have in this maybe cultural arena.
Turner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometimes we have biases in the system. So when somebody uses their biases and excludes individuals specifically because they are not favorable to them, regardless of their, you know, the merit system that exists, will that be looked into? Because this this bill does not protect that for those individuals who may be excluded because of biases.
Representative Reimer.
Madam Chair, Representative Noor. I think this bill actually protects against bias. That's the whole point of the bill. So if there's inherent bias, and it could be, right, in a hiring situation, it could be that somebody might favor a specific ideology or a specific way of thinking. I think that this bill protects against the very thing that you're talking about.
Thank you. Are you done, Chair Noor? Thank you. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Reimer, as you know, we also as a state publicly subsidize to a pretty significant extent private colleges and universities. Why does this bill not apply to them?
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Coulter, because it's a public institution. It's essentially an arm of the government. We don't have private schools approaching and bonding committee asking for $200 million on a yearly basis from the state of Minnesota. It's essentially an arm of what we just had a conversation about regions. We literally determine the leadership of our public institutions here at the state legislature based on the last debate, kind of, I guess, you know. But it is it's a public institution versus a private institution.
Thank you. Anything else? Yes, Representative Coulter.
So the private colleges are not asking us for bonding dollars, but they sure are asking us for state grant dollars. We spend quite a lot of money from the state grant going to private colleges and universities, both for-profit and non-profit, I should add. So I think it's just curious to me that this doesn't apply to private colleges. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would note for the record that the state grant goes to students, not to institutions. Representative Chair Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to request a roll call vote on this motion.
A roll call has been requested and granted. So if there's no further discussion, I'm sorry. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I had to step out, so thank you so much. I did hear Representative Coulter's question, and I just kind of wanted to, like, I know I heard your response too, Chair, but I think we have to be honest that whether, I mean, it goes to the student, but, like, the student is giving that money to the institution, and so I just want to, be really clear about that. Like, it does go to, like, they do benefit from it, and we absolutely have people from private places coming forward and asking for funds. Welcome to the Higher Education Committee, Representative Reimer. This is a pretty hot topic you just broached into here. But that is a highly contentious statement to say that they don't approach us for money. We are looking at a lot of institutions that need assistance. Our private colleges are valued institutions here, and there's a lot of conversation about how we do continue to support them. But I do agree that with this, and I you may not know this, our committee does, but I've had a very personal experience at a private college here in Minnesota that is a religious college, and that very clearly, I mean, your bill should apply to them. I mean, you should hear my story sometime, because I was not allowed to continue going to the college because of who I am, right? And so I would encourage you to, like, maybe broaden the stakeholder base you might be talking to. I know folks in, like, my queer community, like, we would love to talk to you about how this impacts us. And so I hope those conversations continue and that the perspective broadens a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Reimer.
I just want to make a clear distinction, and Representative Hansen, thanks for the comments. Because a student gets grant dollars or because there are PSEO credits, that does not entitle the state to be shareholders in a private institution. There are clear boundaries between what constitutes a public institution and what constitutes a private institution.
Thank you. So, members, I renew my motion that HF 3101 be sent to the Judiciary Committee. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Robbins?
Aye.
Chair Wolgamott?
Wolgamott votes no.
Vice Chair Schwartz?
Aye.
Vice Chair Coulter?
No.
Representative Allen?
Allen votes aye.
Representative Duran?
Yes.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Hicks? Representative Cleburne?
Cleburne, no.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Noor?
No.
Representative Devani? Representative Rarick?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
There being 7 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail, and we will be laying HF 3101 over. Thank you. Next up, we have 7 minutes or 8 minutes, I believe, and we are going to bring up HF 4572 from Representative Duran. Representative Duran, welcome to the committee, and I believe that this bill is going to Representative Duran moves to lay this bill over, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I wasn't sure if I should have thrown on the boxing gloves before I started over here. Or... going to continue to be, should be all right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me present House File 4572 to ensure higher education dollars are spent wisely and effectively. This legislation directs the Office of Higher Education to stop allocating state money to lower earning degree programs. These programs that have lost eligibility for federal funding under U.S. law because they failed to provide students with sufficient earning after graduation. Under this current system, some state funding may go to programs that do not adequately prepare students to the workforce, having them with lifelong debt and limited employment opportunities. So, and I think there's a...
Yes, we have a testifier by Zoom, Christian Barnard. Are you able to join us?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of FGA Action, and I strongly encourage your support for House File 4572. So the federal One Big Beautiful Bill Act created a new minimum earnings threshold for post-secondary education programs to qualify for federal aid, often called the Do No Harm Test. So put simply, the test ensures only college programs whose graduates earn more than high school graduates qualify for federal student loans. HF 4572 builds on this reform by ensuring no state financial aid subsidizes programs that lose eligibility for federal aid because of their poor outcomes. I'll just stress that the Do No Harm Test is a very low bar. The median annual wage for young high school diploma only workers in Minnesota is $36,491 a year, about $17.50 an hour for a full-time worker. I'll say too, preliminary data released by the U.S. Department of Education examines nearly 1,400 institution-specific higher education programs in Minnesota with available earnings data. Only 47 of them, about 3%, are at risk of losing eligibility for federal aid. The bulk of the students affected by these provisions are enrolled in several Minnesota-based online master's programs and allied health services, although there are other affected programs. Accountability based on college graduate earnings has bipartisan support. A former Education Department official under the Obama administration was a chief advocate of the Do No Harm Test at the federal level, and left-leaning organizations such as the Institute for Higher Education Policy have voiced support for the Do No Harm standard on consumer protection grounds. HF 4572 protects taxpayers and students by shielding them from costly programs that simply don't pay off. It's for these reasons that I encourage you to advance HF 4572. Thank you for hearing my testimony, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. We have 3 minutes. Is there any person who wants to ask a question in member discussion? Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. Representative Duran, I really support making sure that we don't have students taking out debt for things they can't afford. But there are two programs that are near and dear to my heart in this state that I think might be affected. So it's the Occupational Skills Program at Ridgewater and at Central Lakes College. Both of those programs are occupational skills for people with disabilities. They are college programs. So I need to know, like, if this would impact that, because those programs are very, very near and dear to my heart, specifically.
I think I would
Representative Duran.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I would have to look into the numbers just to make sure this would actually, I mean, those programs, I'm not aware of those programs right now.
They're specific programs for students with disabilities who are working specifically to earn the skills to be able to work in community. They're very, very important to me. Mm-hmm. And in the past, when the federal government has done similar things, they have lost the ability to use financial aid. So this very much concerns me for those students. Okay. So I'd love some information. I know we're laying it over, so if you could find out, I'd really appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Thank you, Representative Duran. Quickly.
Yep. And maybe the testifier might have a little bit more to say on that.
I think you can work with him to get back to Representative Hicks. We're going to go to Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we are pressed for time, so I'll be quick here. I'm not going to ask you to define what low earning means, even though I really want to. But the information I have says that this could, and I think the testifier even acknowledged, it could include some allied health professions. The information I also have indicates that it could include medical and dental assistants, even potentially folks studying early childhood care and development. And the reason I bring that up is that I think the question we need to ask is, whose failure is it that these occupations are low earning? Is it the people studying them, or is it us as a society because we aren't paying these folks who do really, really important and critical work enough to get by?
Thank you. Representative Duran, any comment?
I'm good.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I will be really fast, Chair Robbins, I promise. I am going to go back to the same thing. Again, I'm a student of Chair Pawlowski, and I have to talk about enrollment. I mean, if we are saying that we can't give funds out to some of these things that Representative Coulter, Representative Hicks mentioned, and goodness forbid, like whatever other professions or degrees that the Trump administration decides are low earning, we need to address the enrollment problem. So I would hope, since we're laying this over, that you would bring forward language that would help address what your plan is to compensate for that loss of enrollment when you potentially would cut off those potential programs. And I think our comments earlier about, you know, do the prior bills say that you can't go to college or you're restricted from it? I mean, this actually does do that, because if people wanted to pursue some of the things that the Trump administration has identified as a low-earning program, that's great. Is it social work next? Is it teaching? Is it nursing? Is it, what is it? I think I would like also for some resources, if we could, from whoever runs that next committee where this comes up again, or if it comes up in a budget bill or an omnibus bill, to have some of those resources so we could know specifically at that time what the Trump administration is considering or which professions he's classifying as that at the time.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Duran, quickly.
Be glad to work with anybody to make this thing better.
Thank you. With that, HF 4698 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.